And thank you so much for joining me. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. And as always, we're wishing you the best. Today, we have as our guest, Dr. Kevin Spellman. Dr. Spellman is a molecular biologist, phytochemist, clinician, and herbalist who has worked with medicinal plants in the field, in the clinic, and in research models, including clinical human trials and preclinical models. He has practiced phytotherapy at several clinics and was a co-founder of the first fully accredited Master of Science degree in clinical herbal medicine. And we will be talking to Dr. Kevin very soon. I want to welcome all of you to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. And I'd love to invite you to join us in our many classes and workshops that we have going on. And they also offer CE credits. And we offer CE credits for a variety of licensed professionals, including nurse practitioners, registered nurses, registered dietitians, clinical nutritionists, and licensed massage therapists and acupuncturists. So if anyone out there needs CE credits, just go to naturalnurse.com and look on calendar. You'll see our up and coming classes, many of which are free. We have a free one coming up this week, which is all about iron. Do you know the difference between heme and non-heme iron? Do you know which one might be absorbed better and why? Do you know the molecular structure of those two and the difference? And what about, what's the best iron if you're giving an iron pill? Would it be ferrous sulfate, ferrous gluconate, and why? And all kinds of interesting things that go along with iron. And that happens to be a free class. If you are not a health professional, you're welcome to take any of our classes anyway. You don't have to get the CE credits. You just take it for your own information and knowledge. And maybe some of you want to move into doing something in natural for your profession. So for that, we have a class coming up called Career Paths in Natural Health. So we have such a huge variety of offerings. Go to naturalnurse.com and calendar to see the classes that are on the way. Or get in touch at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. So we'd love to bring on board our guest for today, Dr. Kevin Spellman. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Spellman.
Well, thanks for having me, Ellen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, I hear you're on. So I guess we made it through the Zoom maze. That's wonderful.
Yes, we did.
To know. And you have such an interesting story. And I'm just going to do a little personal shout out with you right now, Dr. Spellman, because I have to tell you, your name came up because I work with Dr. Lynn Lafferty, who is a PharmD, and she was recently my guest on this show, but we also live near each other and have been working on various projects together. And she mentioned you as being a presenter at a workshop that she put together. So that was a nice reference. And I said, yes, he's going to be a guest on our show as well. But let's go back in time because you have such a unique focus in terms of not only herbal medicine, but phytochemistry. How did all that come into your life?
Well, I suppose if we really traced it back far enough, it was a personal quest to improve my own health. I was not a healthy child, and every time I went to the doctor, nothing really came of it in terms of improvement in my health. And so I started researching on my own at a very early age and eventually found my way into medicinal plants and was just enamored by these wonderful beings growing in the wild that could be very useful to us.
So you came at it more of a health perspective rather than, let's say, a naturalist perspective where you were, you know, like walking in the woods and looking at plants and wondering about them. You actually were sort of introduced to them from a medicinal perspective.
That's true. Yeah, I started from the medicinal, from the pharmacological place rather than a naturalist place. But as a naturalist, I was in the field for 10 years in the backcountry of the Western United States. Unfortunately, when I was seeing all kinds of medicinal plants under my nose, which I didn't know at the time, so unfortunately that came before my quest into the medicinal properties.
So you're talking about now you were out west.
That's right. Yeah. From the Canadian border to the Mexican border, I spent 10 years in the backcountry doing exploration surveys, which was just a wonderful way to grow up into being a young man.
And what were you looking for at that time?
Back in those days, we were looking for precious metals. And I can proudly say that 99 out of 100 properties we looked at, nothing ever happened to them.
Oh, because they didn't get dug out of the ground. Only
That's right. Yeah. That's
because
right.
Now, much different list of heavy metals are being evaluated at this point because of our move into, you know, basically a computerized society. So that's really an interesting thing. I lived for years in Arizona. My children were actually born in Bisbee, Arizona. And that is a real center for all kinds of minerals because it's a copper mine with all the related minerals that go along with copper.
That's right. I actually spent many years working out of Bisbee, Arizona.
You did?
Yes.
What years, can I ask?
Yeah, it was the 80s.
Oh, well, my children were born there. I had an off-the-grid farm and a totally off-the-grid community in Bisbee, Arizona. And by the 80s, I was probably gone because I was there earlier. My children are 47 and 42. So a little before you. But what a phenomenal place, isn't it?
Yeah, Ellen, I think we're giving away our age right now.
That's okay with me, because that means we have lots of experience, which certainly helps in terms of, you know, knowing both the progression of natural medicine, and in particular, what you're talking about with phytochemical research, because that was not being discussed that much. You know, it was, like everything else, I would say phytochemistry has gone through cycles, because pharmacists used to be really focused on phytochemistry and, in fact, pharmacognosy.
That's really true. And pharmacognosy, before I did my doctorate, I actually looked into pharmacognosy programs. And at the time, this would have been in the 90s, at the time, there was only two programs left in the country that were true pharmacognosy programs and not just medicinal plant chemistry, which is quite different.
Well, tell us the difference.
Yeah, it's a dying art, unfortunately.
So what is the difference between plant phytochemistry and phytocognosy?
Well, pharmacognosy includes every step of the way into making a plant into a medicinal agent, where medicinal chemistry really is just focusing in on and drilling down on the active molecules in the plant. So it would really ignore a lot of the other molecules in the plant. For example, molecules that could actually be very useful for absorption, changing the pharmacokinetic properties of something.
And see, this was what was being done, believe it or not, I know you believe it, but in terms of our audience, by the pharmaceutical companies. And not that long ago, because when I say not that long ago, in the last century, all the drug company manuals were about what you're talking about, how to make plants more active as a drug.
That's exactly right. And if you look at, for example, the United States Pharmacopoeia, and you trace it back to the 40s and the 50s, if you get a copy of a pharmacopoeia from then, you'll find all kinds of medicinal plants listed in there.
Yeah, and we're talking about 1950s. You know, it's not really that long ago.
And then, it's really not.
And so it was really kind of, and this is what I don't understand, Dr. Kevin, I'd be interested in your take on that. These plants still have those actions, both as a full plant and even more so when they were, you know, naturally manipulated to have one chemical be expressed more than another. They still have phenomenal healing actions, yet it has, the whole entire science has been removed basically from teaching that to pharmacists or doctors.
Yeah, and I find that really unfortunate, because what it means is that, excuse the pun, that we've forgotten our roots, that we don't know where many of the molecules come from that we currently use in medicine. If you look at the current pharmacopoeia that a physician would write, or a family nurse practitioner would write a prescription from, 50% of all those molecules in there, all those drugs, are from plants in one way or another. Either they're directly derived from a plant or they're now synthesized molecules because it's cheaper than using the plant.
Oh, well, there's a big important word. It's for the companies, it's cheaper once they're able to synthesize a particular molecule than to extract it from a plant. But I think even more importantly is that they can actually change the structure enough to where they can then patent it.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, right? If they can patent it, then they've got something to protect their economic interest. Where, and this is a huge issue in terms of medicinal plants, when you've got a natural molecule, naturally occurring molecule, it is quite difficult, if not impossible, to patent that these days. And so pharma is really not interested. And so they want something synthetic.
Right. That is so interesting. And that doesn't discount, though, what you discovered, which is very often the healing capacity of plant medicine is often superior than what you're going to get with a pharmaceutical drug. Because to me, it's always amazing that a plant often naturally contains another substance, not what you're using it for, not the main thing you're using it for, but something else that offsets any kind of adverse effect. And it just naturally is there. I'll bring up, let's say, white willow bark that I'm sure you're familiar with. And it has some similar chemistry as salicylate, salicylic acid. And yet it also contains demulcents, which are soothing molecules right within it, so that it offsets some of the effects that people get even from taking an aspirin, some of the negative effects.
And I think that's the big difference that's often missed by typical Western-trained pharmacologists and physicians is they forget that there's much more to a medicinal plant than one active compound. And often in those pharmacological models, they would throw out everything except that one molecule, in the case that you're mentioning, that's the salicins. Rather, there is other stuff going on. So not only are there demulcents in willow bark, but there's also other molecules to help facilitate the absorption of the salicins. And we tend to miss this, I think, often.
Oh, that's amazing. So I'm talking about something that might offset a negative effect, and you're talking about something that may give it an additional healing potential. And all of that is missed when we isolate and concentrate out just one saleable compound.
That's right. And if you look at the argument to do this, the rational argument is, well, it gives us more control of the dosage, but that's not necessarily true. If you look at the properly prescribed pharmaceuticals, if you look at those numbers of people that have been adversely harmed or even died from properly prescribed pharmaceuticals, it's in the top 10 of all causes of death.
Top 10? Wait a minute. I read a study saying it was the fourth leading cause of death. Pharmaceuticals used as indicated. That's pretty high.
It's pretty high, and it depends on who you read. Yeah, I've seen studies that suggest it's the top three, but anyway, it's at least in the top 10, right? And that should get all of our attention. And then people talk about how potentially dangerous herbs are, and I just have to roll my eyes and say, this isn't about public health. This is about economics.
Wow, that is so true. Not that every single plant or even medicinal herbs that are on the market today, every single one is totally safe all the time for everyone. But there's certainly a very small list of people passing away from it. While with pharmaceutical drugs, it's huge.
It's true. And for every one of those deaths we see from a dietary supplement, the press really blows it up. And we don't hear about the thousands of deaths in comparison to one death from a pharma molecule versus the one death we hear from a dietary supplement.
Wow, that is so true. And thank you so much for sharing that with us, Dr. Spellman. Now, that's a big thing that you do is information. You know, through your wonderful website, thespellmanreport.com, and we'll have this listed as a live link on our archive of our show today. And I guess that's a real focus, is to bring all this information you've been studying and gathering so that it's available to basically professionals, but the public as well.
Yeah, I have employed a team of researchers to keep up with the literature on natural products. And so the goal of us, of our team at Spelman Report, is to educate, but also to provide clinical pearls for clinicians. And through looking at the science of botanical medicines and nutraceuticals, but most of it's botanical medicines.
Tell us the difference there of what is your definition of a nutraceutical versus a botanical?
Well, I think a nutraceutical oftentimes is considered something that's already naturally occurring to the in the body, or a precursor to something that's naturally occurring in the body, but not necessarily. But a lot of them are naturally occurring in the body. So if we take something like the carnitines, right, acetyl L-carnitine or carnitine fumarate or something like that, we've got these compounds naturally occurring from foods in our body. So a lot of times what you're doing is you're taking and concentrating a molecule from food and putting that into the diet. And these aren't necessarily micronutrients, such as vitamins and minerals.
Well, one thing that I'm always wondering about, because I'm giving a lecture on iron, and that, by the way, for all you professionals, actually gives you credit, and it's also free. So check out my website at naturalnurse.com under calendar, and that's coming right up. And we talk about something like iron. And then there are a real difference in the molecular structure, for instance, with iron, whether you're getting it from a plant or an animal.
Yeah, and I think that's something that is missed as well, is if you look at, so you can see a graph of what they call chemical space. And if you look at natural products and where they occur on that chemical space as compared to synthetic molecules and where they occur on the chemical space, it's quite interesting because the synthetic molecules that have become drugs all cluster together in one spot on the graph, whereas the natural products are spread out all over. What this means, if you translate that, is that there's potential targets for the natural products that have not been used by pharma yet because of the different properties of these natural product molecules. In other words, they tend to be much more diverse and more complex than pharma molecules.
Well, let's talk about that in terms of plant chemistry is certainly very vast, and that's where many people who choose to eat only plants can get a lot of nutrients. And this isn't I'm not even sure if you have an answer to this, but we'll just throw it out there. You don't have to know everything. But let's say something like carnosine. Is there a place that we might find that, do you know? Because I know it does occur within animal products, but I don't know where it occurs in the plant kingdom.
Carnosine, that's a really great question. It seems to me that there probably is, and this is my guess, that there probably is a naturally occurring source of carnosine in a plant. It's certainly, you find it in meats, and actually you find it in our brains too, as well, naturally occurring. But for a plant molecule, I really don't know. I would guess it is likely.
Okay, well, that was the last stump the expert question, because certainly you are a major expert in plant chemistry. And that is really interesting. Now, are you familiar with the program at Rutgers University in terms of natural plant chemistry?
I am not. I'd love to know more about
Yeah,
that.
because one of the people who I have worked with who really had a very deep knowledge, and because I work with a lot of the herb companies in the industry, well known, which we're not going to mention names now, and some of them have some really expert natural product chemists on staff. So I met this one person, and he had graduated from Rutgers University, which is one of my alma maters. I went to Cornell and then Rutgers. So I did not know there was a natural product chemistry program there, but apparently there is. So that might be interesting for you to also look into. And in your vast amount of research, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of medicinal plants?
That's a really great question. And I'd have to say, and this comes from Michael Moore, not Michael Moore the activist, but Michael Moore the herbalist, who has unfortunately passed away
Oh,
now.
of course, who I knew well because he lived in Bisbee, Arizona.
Exactly,
Yeah.
right. So he once said, the advantage of medicinal plants is that they are broad spectrum and naturally dilute. he went on then to say the disadvantage of medicinal plants is that they are broad spectrum and naturally dilute. So let's unpack that a bit. So by broad spectrum, what do we mean? Well, first we have to realize that plants cannot pick up their roots and run away from something that's threatening them. They have to have a defense that does not involve fleeing, right? So they fight, and they fight chemically. So their defensive compounds, which we will call metabolites for the moment, or perhaps even phytonutrients, hit many different targets due to an evolutionary imperative to protect against all kinds of invaders, herbivores, parasites, bacteria, virus. So think about it. With each molecule a plant builds to protect itself, it's an expense. In other words, the plant has to burn up ATP to make that molecule. So if they could produce a molecule that could act against multiple threats, they were likely to be selected for survival. The plant was likely to be selected for survival. So that gives us an idea of the broad spectrum aspect. Now let's look at the naturally dilute. And this is actually the biggest argument I can make for the safety of plants, is that they're actually naturally dilute. Think about pharmaceuticals. It's usually an isolated compound that, however effective it is, it's a lone actor, right? And so consider how often a human in our recent evolutionary past came in contact or ate a single molecule. That's something that would be exceptionally rare. The rule, rather than the exception here, is that what we consumed was chemically complex. And by any one molecule being diluted in a plant with many other molecules, this is what we've come to know as plants, right? Complex chemistry, complex phytochemistry with lots of phytonutrients in there. And so rather than any one molecule building up and causing toxicity, they're diluted. And so this gives us an idea of the advantages. Now, what are the disadvantages of that? Well, the disadvantage of broad spectrum is that you're not singling in on a single target. However, if you look at the new paradigm of what is currently called as network pharmacology, they're calling for more complex chemical remedies because they're saying just hitting one target isn't enough to treat chronic diseases, especially chronic diseases.
You just gave me a new vocabulary word. I never heard that before within the realm of regular pharmacy. What did you say that was? Network?
Network pharmacology. Yeah, I've done some writing on it, and I'm actually working with a company developing products based on this idea of network pharmacology.
And would those be pharmacy kind of products, or natural health kind of products?
They're naturally occurring. They're natural products. So
they'll be available without a prescription, but
exactly.
You're looking at this aspect of network pharmacology where they may have several actions like a natural product would have.
That's exactly right.
And you're saying that within regular pharmacy, they're starting to look at this concept as well?
That's right. And it's based on systems biology, that model that really came to us from ecology, where we would try to focus in on one species, but we couldn't really focus in on one species and understand the system because there were so many species interacting. So if you pulled one species from the ecological network, it would collapse sometimes or change in a direction that we couldn't predict. And so this is that idea.
Well, that's interesting. When I look at something like, we'll talk about one particular thing that you're probably familiar with. Let's say rosmarinic acid, which is extracted from rosemary. Now, I have to say, not everybody would go, yep, with such definitive recognition as Dr. Spellman would. And we are talking here today with Dr. Spellman and Kevin Spellman. And a very good place to find him is at thespellmanreport.com. So, people can look for more. Now, before we talk about rosmarinic acid in particular, we're going to take a little break and listen to Natural Medicine Chest. And we're listening today to our show on Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back once again to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. Thank you for joining us once again. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. Please visit us at naturalnurse.com. Take a look at calendar and you can join us in our many, many classes and workshops, both for CE credit if you're a health professional of almost any kind, or you just want to learn because you're interested in all of these natural topics that we discuss. Today, our guest is Dr. Kevin Spellman, PhD, Phytochemical Research, Health and Education. You can find him at thespellmanreport.com and also facebook.com/thespellmanreport. And thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Spellman.
Truly my pleasure.
Now, before we went to break, I wanted to bring in rosmarinic acid because I have lots of questions about it. But I know one of the things that we use it for clinically is because it has a very complicated action, perhaps that could be used with this word, network pharmacology, new word for me, in terms of its ability in autoimmune disease. You know, we watch commercials on TV. Those people who watch TV still, there's commercials about someone having autoimmune disease and then they take something, we won't name what it is, and it makes their rashes go away and has a lot of effects. But then if you listen in the background, it also destroys their kidney and their liver and they can't go outside because they catch everything in sight. It turns off their entire immune system. But when we're looking at the action of rosmarinic acid, it's so fascinating to me because it seems to turn off the more aggressive activated T cells that go after our own body tissue. That's why it's called autoimmune. But yet it seems to not turn off the other parts of the immune system. Isn't that an amazing activity?
Yeah, rosmarinic acid is well known for its effects on autoimmune diseases. I was just going to mention that when we first started talking about it. I'm glad to hear that you're on board with it. Yeah, it's got some unique properties that we were talking about broad spectrum. In this case, it seems to focus in and target one particular set of immune problems in people so that they can actually have more of a normal life than they might have otherwise.
So it also, you know, with that effect of turning off the aggressive immune cells, that's why it's autoimmune. These immune cells become dysregulated and they actually go after your own body tissue, not only invading things. That's why it's called autoimmune. And rosmarinic acid, like Dr. Spellman just, but we don't know chemically, at least I don't know, how it makes that decision to sort of turn off those activated immune cells, but yet still leave some parts of your immune system intact.
Well, I think it's important here to step back and talk about what molecules do for our bodies, because I think that there's another way to view it, which helps people grasp what could be going on. And if we stop and think about food for a second, and we realize that during our lifetimes, we're going to eat somewhere between 60 to 100 tons of food. Yes, 60 to 100 tons. And so if we stop and think about that food, all those molecules in that food as being information that we're spreading throughout our body and throughout our tissues, then it becomes a very different scene. So what kind of information are we putting into our body? And this is where rosmarinic acid as a molecule comes in and carries a certain message, a certain informational perspective into the body so that it corrects certain issues. And this is how we developed as humans. If you look back evolutionarily, we spent a huge amount of our time walking around and putting plants in our mouth, because we were after food constantly. And so I think it's important to remember that that's the missing piece. Number one, that we're not moving as much as we used to. But number two, that the plants we're eating are very different than what our ancestors ate.
Well, that's true. Now, especially with something like genetic modification.
Yeah, GMOs... it is very interesting. I'm not sure I want to open that can of worms, but there's a lot of misinformation going on about GMOs. And let's be honest. Let's look at both sides of the story. GMOs have really saved a lot of lives in terms of, for example, blindness in vitamin A and, you know, in rice. But at the other side of it, there is some really remarkable information coming out from science, not from opinion or politics, that tells us that we should be very careful about what we're doing with GMOs.
Well, let me ask you this. What about, what are your feelings about the current technologies that are being used to create the vaccinations for the anti-COVID vaccinations?
Well, the good news is that a lot of those adjuvants that are used in vaccines, for example, mercury and these sorts of dangerous potential heavy metals and other compounds that are potentially toxic, are not being used in this round of vaccines. So that's a good thing. We're basically seeing sugars and fats put in with the actual protein, or the mRNA in this case, that's being injected into the body. So that's the good news. The bad news is that, well, as a scientist, I have to say, we don't know everything in terms of how these vaccines are going to come out. Having said that, what I can say is I feel very strongly that it's a better option to get a vaccine than to not get the vaccine. The dangers of COVID are much higher than the dangers of the vaccine.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that opinion with us. Now, in terms of that plant chemistry, there is certainly a lot of plants that have a pretty significant antiviral action.
There are, and actually just covered one of these in the Spellman report. If we look at licorice, which is rich in glycyrrhizin, a saponin or saponin, some people would call it, a type of a family of molecules. Glycyrrhizin tends to have some very remarkable properties that could be very effective potentially at dealing with COVID. Number one, it tends to be directly antiviral, but it also tends to be indirectly antiviral in that it increases the interferon levels in the body, which interferon is our naturally occurring way of fighting viral infections.
And, you know, it's interesting because I find that there's a lot of ignorance when I lecture at medical schools, which I do all the time. A lot of doctors are starting to be interested in these kinds of things, especially when their own health or the health of their own loved ones has been interfered with. And they find that the best salad of pharmaceuticals don't actually bring back health. They themselves become extremely interested in it. Plus, with people like yourself offering so much background science of why plant medicines work so well. But very often, you know, there are possible negative effects with using plants as well. And one of the ones that always comes up with licorice, which they parrot because it's all they know about plant medicine, and in particular about licorice, is that it might raise your blood pressure.
And that's true. It might raise your blood pressure if, and this is an important if you use extremely high doses, somewhere up around 4 grams plus a day, and you'll probably see what we call pseudoaldosteronism. In other words, the fluids, you tend to hold on to the fluids in the body. However, at lower doses, licorice is perfectly safe.
But yet, you know, the myth within medical circles, that's one herb they know, and they know why you shouldn't take it. But actually, when we look at that science, like you just described, where I saw those studies come from at the time that they were occurring was with people in England who ate little licorice pellets, sort of like some people always chew gum. They carried packets of this around with them and just took it all the time and did get overly high doses. And that exact syndrome that you discussed did occur.
Yeah. And if you look at those, so number one, licorice is these days rarely still has licorice in it.
So you're saying licorice candy here in the United States does not contain any licorice. That's true.
That's what I'm saying. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Better stated.
It's just glue and chemical dye and artificial flavor. But there are still these little things. I think they're called Sensen, mostly from the UK, that actually true dehydrated licorice, little teeny squares of it.
Yeah, and as dehydrated, you can get high doses of it with if you get carried away eating your licorice candy that way.
Exactly. So see how interesting that is? And yet within conventional medicine, they grab on that little story, which as you just described with us, Dr. Kevin, is not necessarily actually true. However, knowing that that's a possibility, if I'm a provider that's going to discuss the use of licorice with a client, if they have totally out of control, very high blood pressure, I might choose a different herb, but that's not most of the population.
That's right. And coming back to, for example, COVID, if somebody were to use licorice, the downside is that you might get high blood pressure if you're using high doses, but blood pressure is very easily treatable versus COVID, right?
Exactly. So you're talking there about a risk-benefit ratio. So
exactly.
When we're talking risk-benefit ratio, and if we were to compare even with any kind of chart at all within mainstream science, the risk-benefit ratio of pharmaceutical drugs versus the risk-benefit ratio of phytotherapeutics, you know, natural remedies blow pharmaceuticals away on that data.
That's right. And it comes back to this therapeutic window where, you know, what is the dose that provides a therapeutic effect? And with pharmaceuticals, that dose tends to be a very small window. In other words, you know, let's take a example of something that you might use at 10 milligrams. Well, at 5 milligrams, it doesn't have an effect, but at 15 milligrams, it might be toxic. When this is the piece on naturally dilute in plants that I actually never finished, was that because plants are naturally dilute, their therapeutic window tends to be very wide. So you might get some mild effects, therapeutic effects at, you know, 500 milligrams, and you might get optimal effects at 1,000 milligrams, and you might still might get effects at 1,500 milligrams that are positive, but it might take 4 or 5 grams to actually cause some sort of an issue. So there's that therapeutic window with plants tends to be much wider.
It's broader.
But also because of that naturally dilute effect, plants take longer to have an impact. And so when I was practicing in full swing, I would actually tell my patients that I needed 3 months for them to actually make an evaluation to see if they were getting better, because plants really do take some time, generally speaking, especially in chronic diseases. You're not going to get better overnight. The problem didn't develop overnight. Your symptoms didn't develop overnight. So they're not going to go away overnight unless you use something super strong. And that necessarily might not be the best direction to go.
That's true. Very often, especially with a more chronic condition. Although there are times when you absolutely can see something immediately. I'll give 2 examples. Since you were talking about licorice, people who have mild dyspepsia, you know, upset stomach and things like that, very often if they use a DGL, which is a deglycerized licorice wafer, they feel it right away.
That's true. There are lots of examples of plants being effective right away. Many of the herbal sedatives you're going to feel them right away. But again, coming back to chronic, if you've got a chronic issue, generally speaking, you need to really look at the issue and think about how did I get here and not just expect a pill to cure you.
That's so true. That's where we come into integrative therapeutics, where we're looking at finding the cause rather than cover up the symptom. And then, yes, it's going to take change. It's going to take perhaps some herbs, but it's not that concept of just pop this pill. It's how did you develop this? What are you eating? What are your food allergies? What are your stress levels? What is your exercise component? You know, all that is brought in, and then the herbs sort of just mildly support moving in the right direction.
Exactly.
So that's true.
That broad spectrum effect. In other words, not only is a plant broad spectrum, but the therapy potentially should be broad spectrum to hit many different aspects of our being.
Well, that's so excellent. And thank you so much, Dr. Spellman. We're going to take another little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, so you can find out more about Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, our wonderful station that we're a part of with lots of great shows. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Dr. Kevin Spellman. You can find out more about him and his work, and you can learn so much more at thespellmanreport.com. And, you know, we're going to go a little bit as a heads up, Dr. Spellman, into your expertise on a big topic today, cannabis and hemp. In fact, I have a Facebook page called The Natural Cannabis Nurse, because I'm very, very involved with cannabis, and I'm on the education committee for the American Cannabis Nurses Association. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Please listen to our shows. They're all posted. We've been here on Progressive Radio Network since its inception, I'm happy to say, as well as many other networks that we have various shows on, and they have been on long enough to be called radio shows. We're kind of losing what is the difference, radio show and podcast, but whatever it is, we love to have you listen to us. And today, our guest is Dr. Kevin Spellman, a molecular biologist, phytochemist, clinician, and herbalist. And thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Spellman.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Now, we were going to migrate over for our last little section here into the cannabis space. Tell us your involvement there.
Well, I have been a CSO, a chief scientific officer for a cannabis company, and I'm currently involved with a company. We've just put out a number of different products specific to constitutional types or the issues that people are having for both sleep and anxiety. So 6 different formulas for sleep, 6 different formulas for anxiety or mood issues.
Okay, so that's your involvement, but how would you say they work? Like there's a concept called the entourage effect when we're looking at not the isolates, but like a whole cannabis extract.
Yeah, so we're hearing a lot about this entourage effect, and I just want to stop and pull back a little bit because people are targeting it towards cannabis, and we have to keep in mind that this is just not about cannabis. This is about medicinal plants in general. And so that's the first thing to think about. But the entourage effect was first introduced back in, I think it was the late 90s. And they were looking at endogenous occurring compounds, compounds that naturally occur in the body, as having an effect together, a few compounds actually having a more potent effect than just one molecule would. And then they realized that this was probably going on with cannabis as well. So this idea, I like to think of it as synergy, but this idea is that because there's multiple molecules doing multiple things in the body, hitting multiple targets in the body, that we have activity going on that is greater than, for example, that if we just took dronabinol or just a THC, isolated THC. So if we stop and look at the number of molecules that hit the cannabinoid one receptor, it's not just THC by any means. We have CBN that hits the CB1 receptor. We have THCV, which hits the CB1 receptor. We have CBG that hits it, although at very low affinity, so not particularly a strong effect. And even CBD binds to the CB1 receptor, but not in the way that you might think, that doesn't bind the receptor pocket, but it binds to the offset to the receptor pocket, which affects the shape of the receptor pocket and thereby attenuates the negative influence of THC on the body.
And what
So
would that
that's one
be? Wait, since you
aspect.
brought that up, what's the negative effect of THC on the body?
So the negative effect obviously is memory, the munchies, these sorts of things. CBD can really help with that. And that's why the only pharmaceutically approved remedy out there isn't just THC, it's THC CBD. And by pharmaceutically approved, I mean naturally occurring directly from the plant. GW Pharma has put out something called Sativex, which is not approved in the US yet, but it is approved in, I think, over 20 countries, I think closer to 30 countries now.
But a Pedialyx is an FDA-approved drug, but it is only a CBD.
That's right. Epidiolex or Pedialyx is just CBD and is approved in the US.
Which is pretty amazing to begin with,
It is. It is. And it's just CBD. It's 98% CBD
So
with some terpenes.
I didn't know about the one that you're talking about, which is a THC CBD that actually is moving towards FDA approval as well.
Yeah, we'll see what happens because of our particular fear of THC in the United States. We'll see what
Well,
happens
which
with
is
it.
rapidly, here in Florida, we're a prescription state and you can pay more money and get a prescription for flowers as well, which is basically just what we used to call smoking pot. I don't know. That's what it looks like to me because my daughter has such a license, right? And she goes to a special store, which is a dispensary, and she just walks in there and buys these beautiful, very potent flowers and rolls them up and smokes them. So if we want to call that medicinal use, that's okay. And it does help her with her various medical issues. But really, it's just moving towards now. So many states are going to, it's just that you just need a license showing you're an adult. No more medical license ne necessary. For instance, in Colorado and now New Jersey.
And Oregon,
That,
I
right.
think there's over a dozen states, actually closer to 20, that have recreational laws now.
Yeah. So what that's doing is just basically making it legal.
Exactly, and for those who oppose it, just stop and think about the damages that alcohol do to our society. And I would have to say that, with rare exception, I do find that cannabis is probably much safer than alcohol.
Right. And we tried stopping the alcohol too, didn't we? I just went to a whole bunch of seminars on that area of our history at the Gold Coast on the North Shore, because the very wealthy people had special places for barges to come in with alcohol, you know, all during the entire time of abolition. So it doesn't seem we can stop these things.
It's true.
So that's really amazing, though, that you're doing research specifically in this field and looking at what you explained to us as the entourage effect, where these various chemicals work together. Sometimes it's called synergistically, or there are other chemical terms to say how they work together. And this is really becoming more and more just widely recognized within mainstream science.
It is. And it's speaking of mainstream science, you know, one of the reasons that this science is only really blowing up now in our culture is that the endocannabinoid system has only really been discovered in the 80s and 90s. It's been a very short time ago that we started to understand that the endocannabinoid system is basically a protective system for the body, especially the brain, but also immunologically as well.
Yeah, that is such an interesting thing to look into, because what they found out, what you're discussing here, Dr. Spellman, when you're talking about endocannabinoids receptors and also endocannabinoids in our body, that inside our body, without taking in any kind of external marijuana or other plants such as echinacea, which also have some of these substances, as well as cacao and other plants, but if we're thinking about even, you know, a hemp or a marijuana type plant, that our body produces and has receptors for these molecules, like they've always been there. We just only just discovered it.
It's true. And it's interesting. If you go through the scientific literature, if you go back before, say, the 90s, what you'll find is most of the literature on THC or cannabis is the harmful effects. And now if you look, you see a huge array of choices in terms of looking at the beneficial effects. So the endocannabinoid system let's say we were selected to have the endocannabinoid system to protect our brains. And this is an important point. People think that THC is going to ruin your brain. Well, certainly you can overdo anything, including alcohol. But in proper dosages, THC is actually protective, as is CBD, as is CBG, as is CBN. All these different molecules have a protective effect. And it's not just about this CB1 receptor. You know, we can look at enzymes such as FA, fatty acid amide hydrolase, and receptors such as the TRP receptors, the nuclear orphan receptors, PPAR gamma, right, also has a role in the endocannabinoid system. So this endocannabinoid system has gone from just being about CB1 and CB2 and a few enzymes to spreading out throughout the body to many different receptor systems and enzyme systems.
So interesting, and that complexity of the cannabis plant. You spoke about some of the cannabinoids, and also I've been recently reading literature on the CBA receptor and showing that it actually can be very linked to something like anxiety, like different clinical aspects of these different cannabinoids.
That's exactly right. And for many people, now in the wrong doses, THC can definitely cause anxiety. In the right doses, it can actually be incredibly relaxing. And this, I think, is an issue, because if you look back at what was available in the 60s in the black market, most of that cannabis was under 6% THC. If you walk into the average dispensary now where you can buy cannabis, most of that cannabis is around 17% or higher THC. So it's very different than what people were accustomed to, and they can easily overdose.
That's another issue. And we'll have to save that discussion for another day, because we're coming to the end of our time together, Dr. Kevin Spellman. It was absolutely fascinating discussion, and I learned a lot of new things, which is why I continue to do these radio shows to bring it to you listeners. But I'm a learning junkie, that's for sure. And all of our guests always have something really fascinating to teach. So as we end here, Dr. Spellman, just tell people the best way they can find out more about you and your research and interact with what you're doing.
Well, I think you've done it already, Ellen. The SpelmanReport.com is probably a really good place. If you're interested in consulting, PhytoChemKS.com. That's PhytoChem, it's PhytoChem. And then my initials, KS.com for the consulting side of things. And it's been a real pleasure to be here, and I wish you well, and I love what you're doing, especially not only just with medicinal plants and natural products, but also with cannabis. Cannabis can be a very useful tool in our culture.
And thank you so much for listening, listeners, for joining us once again right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Until next time, visit our archive, send us a hello, what you like, something else you'd like to hear. We love to hear from you. And until next time, on behalf of myself and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we're hoping that you stay healthy.